On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Well, I'm very excited today about welcoming back to On the Bookshelf Professor John Ferling, who's Professor Emeritus of History at the University of West Georgia, the author of many books on the American Revolution, including The Ascent of George Washington and Apostles of Revolution. In both cases, we had the chance to talk to John Ferling, and we're doing so again today. His newest book is Winning Independence, The Decisive Years of the Revolutionary War, 1778-1781. It's a big, beautiful volume from Bloomsbury Publishing, and we're just thrilled to welcome Professor Ferling back to On the Bookshelf. Thanks for making time to talk to us.
Oh, absolutely. I appreciate you having me.
The place to start would be to explain why we're looking at practically the second half of the American Revolution. This book really picks up the war after the big victory at Saratoga, the French making an alliance with us and so forth, and ends with Yorktown. But there's so much in between, and you've done a really balanced job talking about all of the important players in this on both sides. And I think that's really interesting, because I've never really had as much of an explanation of, say, General Clinton as you have done in this book.
One reason I was really drawn to this topic is that I think Saratoga is obviously a great American victory, and it's often depicted in textbooks and whatever as the turning point of the revolution. And I don't mean to minimize the importance of Saratoga, but I think because it is called the turning point, that many people tend to think that what followed was anticlimactic, and that the American victory was guaranteed, and that what happened going down to Yorktown just tended to get ignored in the shuffle. And what I try to argue in the book is that even though the French came in and General Washington and others thought that independence was now guaranteed and the war would not last very much longer, either the Allies would win the war with a decisive victory very soon, or the British would come to see that it was hopeless to stay in the war and they would negotiate an end of the war and grant America its independence. But instead of that happening, the war pretty quickly stalemated, and it became a long, bitter war that went on for 4 years after Saratoga. And it was a time when the Americans experienced periods that were just as dark and uncertain as those times in 1776, when things had looked hopeless before Trenton and Princeton. And I felt, and I tried to argue in the book, that even deep into 1781, 4 years after Saratoga, the outcome of the war was still unclear. And in fact, you mentioned Sir Henry Clinton. He's the commander of the British Army from 1778 onward. Clinton entered that year 1781 feeling better than he had about any other year since he had taken command. He was confident that if the British could get through that year without suffering a decisive defeat, that the war would end in a negotiated settlement. If the United States existed at all, it would be small, it would be surrounded by British territory, it would face an uncertain future, and that the British in that negotiated settlement would be very likely to retain control of South Carolina and Georgia and possibly even North Carolina, so that the United States might be a union of as few as 10 states. So that was why I was drawn to this topic that I think has all too often been forgotten, and hope to shed some light on that long sort of twilight struggle that goes on for 4 years. And I might mention, too, that it was a very bloody four-year struggle, that actually more Americans died in the 4 years after Saratoga than died in the 30 months of the war before Saratoga. Probably about two-thirds of all the Americans who perished in this war died between 1778 and 1781.
There was a movie that came out a number of years ago, The Patriot, Mel Gibson.
Right.
And it of course, is based kind of roughly on what happened, with some invented characters, of course. But some of the things that they talk about in the movie and some of the things that happened in the movie were not that far from what was really going on. This was a war that was bitterly fought between the partisans and the Tories and the Continentals and the regular British army and the Hessians and the French. And back and forth, there had been enmity between the western half of South Carolina and the eastern half before the war, and it just exploded into basically a civil war in those southern states.
Right, it is a civil war. I mean, the South really experiences two civil wars. Everybody
yeah.
remembers the one in the 1860s, but this was really a civil war, too. You know, in a battle like Kings Mountain, for example, there's about 1,000 men on each side, and only one of the 2,000 men in that engagement was British. All the others were Americans that were fighting one another. And turns out to be a really bloody struggle. The partisans that you referred to that were depicted in that movie, The Patriot, resorted to terror tactics. Oftentimes the British reciprocated, and General Nathanael Greene, who becomes the commander of the last American army that's sent into the Southern Theater. It was the fifth American army to be sent into the Southern Theater during the war, and he takes command in December of 1780 and stays in command for a couple of years. But Greene, who had served for several years in the North, and now he's seeing this war in the South, he wrote to some of his friends in the Continental Army up north, and he said, "You have no idea what war is really like until you would come down here and see what's going on here. These people go after one another like you've never seen before." So it was a pretty war, and there's no question, there's no doubt that the partisans under people like Sumter and Marion and Andrew Pickens and others caused great harm to the British Army. I mean, they caused a great deal of attrition and denied them supplies by raiding them. And maybe the biggest thing that they did was the whole idea, I think, of coming into the South on the part of the British was that they were convinced that there were more loyalists, more people who remained loyal to Great Britain in the South than there were up north. And I think historians have confirmed that and argued that a greater percentage of Southerners did remain loyal to Great Britain. And the idea was that most of these loyalists would be willing to take up arms for their king, and that some of them would join the regular British Army and go into what became known as provincial regiments, and others would join militia forces. And the idea was that the British Army would drive the rebels out of an area, and then the loyalist militia would come in behind them and occupy the area and pacify the area. But the partisans they resorted to terror tactics against the loyalists, murdered them out of hand and whatever. And it didn't take too much of that before many of the loyalists began to have second thoughts about serving in the militia forces. So the partisans deserved a good deal of credit for the outcome of the war in the South and Britain's problems. In the South, I was always dismayed by, I should add, that at the end of the war, Washington delivered two farewell addresses, and they're not as well known as his farewell address when he left the presidency, but he delivered one to the Army at West Point just before he came down, and New York City was liberated right at the end of 1783. And then he went down to Annapolis where Congress was meeting and gave a second farewell address when he surrendered his commission. And in those two farewell addresses, he gives credit to those that he thought were important in winning the war. And in both of those addresses, he omits two groups that were really crucial. He says nothing about the French, And without the assistance of the French, I don't think the Americans could have won the war. And he never mentions the partisans in the South in either of those addresses. Probably overlooked the French for matters of state. I'm not sure why he didn't say anything about the partisans. He wasn't in the South until Yorktown, and maybe he just didn't know that much about, didn't understand the full role that the partisans were playing.
To not mention the French, who basically paid all of our soldiers, sent money to, because we ask, you know, the soldiers are all going to quit unless they get paid. They're mutinying now, and the French sent money to pay our own troops so that they would stay in the field.
They were providing secret assistance as early as 1775, sending in arms and munitions and clothing and blankets for the troops. And then when they allied with the United States in 1778, that clandestine aid became open and they could send over a great deal more, including a navy. And then a year or two later, they sent an army over under Comte de Rochambeau in 1780. Also, Congress on more than one occasion went hat in hand to the French and asked for loans, and the French not only gave them loans, at one point just actually gave them money
right.
that they didn't have to pay back. The American economy had absolutely collapsed by 1778 or so. Without all of that French aid, whether it was money or uniforms or arms or whatever, the Americans simply could not have won the war. They just couldn't, they didn't have the staying power against a great power like Great Britain.
We're talking, in case you're just joining us, to John Ferling, the author of Winning Independence, The Decisive Years of the Revolutionary War, 1778-1781. It's from Bloomsbury, big, beautiful book, and just loaded with information. Most of the time, we don't really realize how close England got to winning our revolution, not only because for a while they were winning all the battles in the South, but also because they did still own East Florida, and East Florida was requested to send troops and support. So basically, the eastern seaboard from Virginia down to Florida was engaged in this second half of the war.
Absolutely. The last major battle in the North was the Battle of Monmouth in June of 1778. So from then until Yorktown in 1781, all of the major engagements are in the South, and most of them went against the United States. The U.S. lost four armies that were just utterly destroyed. Between December of 1778, they lost the first army at Savannah. In December of 1778, they lost a second army at Savannah. In 1779, they lose the army and the city of Charleston in the spring of 1780. And at the Battle of Camden in South Carolina in August of 1780, General Horatio Gates just suffers an egregious defeat at the hands of Cornwallis. And there's no coincidence that in August of 1780, the month of Camden, the month of that fourth American army that had been lost, altogether, more than 8,000 American troops had been killed, wounded, or captured in those four defeats. I don't think it's any coincidence that in that same month of 1780, George Washington wrote a letter to an acquaintance, and he said, "I have almost ceased to hope for independence." And I think just as telling is in that same month of August of 1780, Arthur Lee from Virginia, who had been an American diplomat since early in the war, returned home to America for the first time since before the war, and he landed in Boston. And he's there for a few days before continuing his journey on home to Virginia. But while he's in Boston, he said he talked to a number of leaders in Boston and from Massachusetts, and they told him at that point that they felt that the war would almost inevitably end in a negotiated settlement, with America having to accept less than independence. In other words, it would remain part of the British Empire. And that same month of 1780, and maybe for the same reason that Washington was despairing, there was another figure on the move, and that was Benedict Arnold. Mm. And he had been talking for a long, long time through intermediaries to the British commander, Sir Henry Clinton, about defecting. In fact, Clinton didn't even know who it was. He just knew that there was a high American official who might defect. And in August 1780, Arnold makes the decision to turn coat and tries to turn over West Point, which would have been a fatal move for the Americans. So things were really going very, very badly at that point, and just defeat after defeat after defeat was piling up down in the Southern theater.
I found it very interesting, because I'd never really put this together until I read your book, Winning Independence, that Washington was elated, of course, to have the French openly declare their alliance with us. But because he was wanting to be respectful, he pretty much sat around for over a year doing nothing, waiting for the French to make it convenient for him to enact one of the plans. He was constantly coming up with new strategies, which were reliant on the French Navy or the armies that they would bring with them. And he kept getting disappointed. And so he just sat there and got enormously frustrated that his hands were tied, and he knew it looked bad.
Once Washington learns that the French are coming into or allying with the United States, and they'll be co-belligerent in this war, that Washington was at Valley Forge at that point, and he said he thought the French alliance guaranteed American independence. And then he said something that was really, I found rather interesting. I quoted in the book. He said that from this point on, he would avoid acting with impetuosity. Mm-hmm. And I think what he meant by not acting impetuously was he didn't define it, but I think if you look at his behavior that you just characterized over the next 4 years, what Washington was really saying was that he was not going to act without the consent of the French and without the cooperation of the French. And it may have been, he had made a lot of mistakes in 1776 and 77, and there was a great deal of criticism of Washington within the Army and mm-hmm. within Congress during that winter of 1778. He may have just feared to act on his own, or to be more charitable to Washington, he may simply have not wanted to take risks that would weaken his army, that was already pretty weak anyway, before they could cooperate with the French. So he is, as you said, really idle. The British are far more active in this four-year struggle after Saratoga than Washington. But Washington comes out of Valley Forge really above criticism. There had been a great deal of carping about Washington, even possibly a move to dump Washington as the commander, and that would have probably just absolutely destroyed the war effort, and Congress understood that. So the Congress does what it can to put a stop to the attacks on Washington, and it also begins to take whatever steps it can to make Washington into an iconic figure, things like celebrating his birthday annually and things of this sort, and hiding any failures that came along. The first one that I'm aware of after Valley Forge who openly criticized Washington was Thomas Paine, and he didn't do it until the 1790s, and he wrote a blistering pamphlet attacking Washington then in about 1795 or 96. But Paine said Washington slept in the field for all of those years, as he put it, and that Nathaniel Greene and Horatio Gates were the real heroes of the Revolution. And Paine paid dearly for that. He understood that to attack Washington was the third rail of American politics. You couldn't do it. And Paine learned his lesson the hard way.
Yeah, I remember that from your previous book.
Right, yeah.
Cornwallis is the bright hope of the British government. Germain and the king believe he's the guy that's going to do the thing. And his commanding officer, Henry Clinton, gives him his lead. But he finds out to his chagrin that Cornwallis does not always tell exactly the truth. When Cornwallis makes some serious errors, he claims victory in a battle that wasn't a victory. he begins to realize that Cornwallis needs a tighter rein, but it's almost too late at that point to do that, isn't it?
Clinton went a very long time in 1781 without hearing from Cornwallis. Cornwallis was out in the field from January until deep into April, and so he was unable to communicate with Clinton, who was up in New York. So Clinton, for a long time, had no idea really what was. Then when he began to hear from Cornwallis, as you said, Cornwallis was embellishing his letters with claims of victory that he really hadn't won. I think Clinton began to see problems in the South. He understood that the partisans were causing really serious problems for the British, and Cornwallis suffered a string of defeats at Kings Mountain, Cowpens, and Guilford Courthouse between October of 1780 and March of 1781. The combination of those things caused Clinton to rethink his strategy for winning the war in the South. And I think Clinton came up with a strategic plan that would have led to British success in the South. And what Clinton concluded that the rebellion in the South essentially hinged on supplies coming down to, whether it was a rebel army under Nathanael Greene or whether it was partisans under Sumter or Marion or others, that the only way that they could really be a viable force against the British was through getting supplies. And for the most part, the Americans got their supplies from overseas. We just had no manufacturing capability. So the supplies came from abroad, and they generally entered New England ports, and then they flowed south down through Philadelphia, Maryland, Delaware, into Virginia, and down through Virginia into North Carolina, and then through North Carolina, principally through Charlotte, down into South Carolina and into the hands of the partisans and the rebel armies that were there. So Clinton's plan was to shut off the flow of supplies. And what he came up with beginning at the very end of 1780 was for the first time to put a British army into Virginia. He sent an army under Benedict Arnold, his newfound general, and they arrive in Virginia in December of 1780. It's a fairly small army. It's only 1,800 men, and Clinton soon concluded that the army was so small it was probably vulnerable. So he sends a much larger army under General William Phillips in March of 1781. And ultimately, he brings the total of British troops in Virginia up to about 6,000 men. And their objective is to destroy rebel supply depots and interdict the flow of supplies into the Carolinas. And at the same time, just the fact that they are present in Virginia would force Virginia's governor, who was Thomas Jefferson at the time, to keep Virginia militiamen in Virginia rather than sending them down into the Carolinas. So I think it was a plan that could have worked. A 6,000-man army had the capability of stopping the flow of supplies. And while that was going on in Virginia, Cornwallis was to stay in South Carolina and crush the partisans and crush any rebel army that did come into South Carolina. So I think it was a viable plan, and it might have worked, and it might have led to the war ending with Britain in control of Georgia, South Carolina, and North Carolina, possibly North Carolina, but certainly Georgia and South Carolina. But the plan went awry because of Cornwallis. Cornwallis, though he was ordered by Clinton to stay in South Carolina, violated that order, and he marched his army to Virginia in May of 1781. That army winds up, of course, at Yorktown in Virginia. All along, I think Clinton felt that there would be a decisive battle in 1781. He was convinced, and I think he was right, that the Allies had to score a decisive victory in 1781 or France was going to drop out of the war. British intelligence was reporting that, and John Adams, who was an American diplomat in Europe, was telling Congress the same thing, that the French have been in the war for 3 years and they haven't accomplished one single thing out of it. So if they can't score a decisive victory in 1781, they're going to pull out and negotiate a settlement. And who knows what that negotiated settlement would have been. So Clinton was looking for a decisive showdown, and he was absolutely convinced that it would occur in New York, that the French and the Americans would try to regain New York, which was the biggest prize. So from the beginning, even though he had put 6,000 men in Virginia, his plan was to withdraw all but about 2,000 of those men back to New York for this showdown against the Allies. But Cornwallis came to Virginia. That builds up the army to about 7,500 men. And even then, Clinton sent orders in June of 1781 for Cornwallis to send 3,000 of his men to New York. It's kind of the first installment on the removal of the British troops in Virginia. And Cornwallis obeyed that order. He was in the process of loading his men on transports for the trip to New York when he got a second letter from Clinton that countermanded the first order. And Clinton reversed himself because you mentioned Lord George Germain a while ago. He's the American secretary, the guy who's really responsible for managing the war, kind of a war minister of sorts. And Clinton had heard from Germain, and Germain said that he and the king absolutely were opposed to the removal of one single British soldier from Virginia. So Clinton countermanded the order, and all 7,500 British troops remain in Virginia. And the result is the showdown comes in Virginia and not in New York. In fact, I can't answer this, but one of the things to mull over is if the Allies had to score a decisive victory, and if it came down to a decision of trying to score that victory in New York or in Virginia, and if there were only 2,000 men in Virginia, as Clinton had hoped for, by withdrawing all the others, would the Allies have thought that Virginia was worth going after? Would that have been too small? And would they have chosen to attack New York? And could they have scored a decisive victory in New York? After all, the British had occupied New York for 5 years, had 5 years to construct defensive installations there. So I can't answer what might have happened there, but the point is that first Cornwallis comes to Virginia, which he never should have done, never should have abandoned South Carolina. Then secondly, Germain prevents Clinton from withdrawing the troops from Virginia. And as they say, the rest is history.
It is an amazing story. And I think that there will be plenty of people who read your book who will be surprised at some of the things that happened and how it could have gone either way for such a long time. And what a providential thing it was for Cornelius to take his army into Virginia thinking that he was going to score a big coup and instead got caught in a big trap. It's a great story. John Ferling, our guest today, his newest book, Winning Independence, The Decisive Years of the Revolutionary War, 1778-1781, from Bloomsbury Press. Professor Ferling, do you have a website people can go to or anything?
I do. It's just johnferling.com. Google John Ferling and it'll come up, John Ferling Home, or it's johnferling.com.
Thank you very much, sir. A fascinating book, and sir, enjoyed your time with us again.
All right. Well, thank you once again for having me.
Yes, sir. Our thanks once again to John Ferling, the author of Winning Independence, The Decisive Years of the Revolutionary War, 1778-1781, from Bloomsbury Press. And once again, his website is John Ferling, that's ferling.com. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and podcast. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless America.